owning it all this week on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Marco Werman is on assignment in Kenya, and this week he'll have the stories of African women whose business is their own.
They are able to come up with small businesses that they can earn living through savings alone. They are able to put dinner on the table.
Coming up, women owning it in Kenya. Also, Saudi women gain some political clout, and a reporter revisits her favorite hotel in the war-torn Syrian city of Homs.
It was all lit up with Christmas lights. There was a whole array of new shops. It was a sense that the danger and the violence that we used to hear every night from the hotel had come to an end.
Those stories, plus think twice about that shrimp you're about to eat, ahead on The World. Marco's on assignment in Kenya this week. He's there reporting on women and economic empowerment. More on that later in the show. We begin, though, with an update on Syria's civil war. And specifically, we're going to hear about the situation in Homs. For 3 years, the city's been fought over by government forces and an assortment of rebels. Then last week, the fighting there ended. The rebels cut a deal with the government for safe passage out of the city. That allowed Western reporters the chance to get in. Among them was my BBC colleague, Lise Doucette. She's back in London now, and she says the truce deal in Homs is a significant step in the war.
The opposition used to call Homs, and they still do, in effect, the capital of their revolution, since it saw some of the first peaceful protests against President Assad's rule and then saw some of the fiercest fighting. Now the government says that all of Homs is under its control.
Is it an empty city? Is it are people returning? What's it like being there?
It is a city both of light and of dark. I was surprised to see that when I walked into the main hotel, which has been used as a headquarters for the United Nations, has served as a place to meet when negotiations for the local truces were going on. So over the years, I've seen UN military observers there. I've seen spooks and journalists and people gathering. This time, it was all lit up with Christmas lights. There was receptions there. There was a whole array of new shops that had been opened in the lobby, everything from selling lingerie to children's clothes to mobile telephones. It was a sense that the danger and the violence that we used to hear every night from the hotel had come to an end. But there's still great darkness in Homs because there are vast neighborhoods which lie in utter complete ruin, haunted ruins that you see not a building standing, every building charred, gutted, pockmarked with bullet holes or flattened into these gray cement pancakes by the ferocious bombardment. And from those cities left the people who formed the backbone of the uprising against President Assad's rule. So it will take a long time before people come back to the city. And we're not just that buildings are rebuilt again, but a whole social fabric.
It's hard to believe there are still people living in Homs after 3 years of violence and war. Tell us about some of the people you met on this latest visit.
You can go through some neighborhoods in Homs and you'd think that there was never a war at all, where the traffic is bustling, the traffic lights are blinking, the pizzerias are doing brisk business, the cafes are full, people are out in the markets. And then you go to another neighborhood, which is completely and utterly destroyed. One of the areas which I made a point of going back to this time was the charming old city, an ancient quarter that's been much loved by Syrians from across the country. It too had seen some of the worst of the fighting in this war. It was a besieged area cut off from the government to try to force the fighters there to surrender. We saw the local ceasefire unfold there in May 2014, and I went to the old city at that time to find a shattered city where not a single building was inhabitable and where the fabled church of St. Mary of the Holy Belt had the stone floor of a stone church was scratched and scarred. There were no lights. The only lights were the candles being lit by the visitors who were so relieved to be able to come back to their place of worship. There were no pews, no seats in the church. I went back to that lovely church last week and found a completely different place. The pews had all been restored, honey-colored pews and orderly arrangement as you'd expect in a church. In one corner, a nativity scene as Christians would recognize anywhere, a glittering Christmas tree, candles, even a Santa Claus in a corner that was made out of white plastic cups with lights glittering inside. And Christians were coming to worship again. But most of the old city is still a place, a dark place of ruin. On every street, there was at least one shop or one home which was being repaired. Slowly, slowly, people are coming back, but it will take a long time before it returns to anything that could ever be described as normal.
The BBC's Lise Doucette, just back from the Syrian city of Homs. Syria is also a key battleground in the war against ISIS. The extremist group proclaimed another Syrian city, Raqqa, as its capital. Well, today, President Obama had a message for those who lead ISIS, or ISIL, as he prefers to call the group.
We're going after ISIL from their stronghold right in downtown Raqqa to Libya, where we took out Abu Nabil, the ISIL leader there. The point is, ISIL leaders cannot hide, and our next message to them is simple: you are next.
Obama also said the U.S. is hitting ISIS harder than ever with airstrikes. The president made his comments at the Pentagon, where he discussed ISIS strategy with his top national security advisors. Vikram Singh is a former senior official at both the Pentagon and the State Department. He's now with the Center for American Progress in Washington.
I don't think there's much new in terms of the actual strategy. The president has been intensifying the effort against ISIL for months. In fact, I think they announced intensification of the effort well before the attacks in Paris or San Bernardino. I think the thing to focus on is not so much what are they doing militarily in Iraq and Syria, but it's all those other pillars of the strategy. They have five pillars to this overall strategy, things like countering terrorist financing, things like countering their propaganda. And in a way, those are the things we should be focusing on, because bombing Raqqa isn't going to stop San Bernardino.
Any of those things you just ticked off, any evidence that any of that's happening?
Yes, I think there are efforts in all of the areas. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I just think it shows you actually what's harder and what's less hard. So the in a way, the easier thing to do is to go after terrorist strongholds and to target leaders. We're very good at that. We did that for many years, for example, against Al-Qaeda in the Fatah region and Pakistan-Afghanistan border areas. And we really disrupted Al-Qaeda. But even that is still an ungoverned space. And so the challenge is, can we figure out those other pieces to actually to help return governance to places like Libya so that they don't become the next terrorist launching pad, or to drive ISIL out of Syria, and then overall to start countering this overall propaganda effort that seems to still be attracting a lot of adherents from countries across the West and the whole world.
This other thing that's going on, the Pentagon has put forward a new plan to establish a network of permanent bases to combat terrorist threats from the Atlantic to Afghanistan. What's your understanding of that plan? What's the idea behind it?
So they haven't done much more than talk in vague terms about what that's actually going to entail. But it looks like they're looking at using a few places where we already have some assets in Spain and a base in Afghanistan, and basically saying, hey, let's use these as anchor points so that we'll be able to both help local partners, and if there's a crisis, we'll actually have some more capabilities close by if something should happen. I think this is very clearly partly a reaction to Benghazi, the next steps in trying to figure out, hey, when the Benghazi attacks went down, one problem was there were not capabilities close enough by that could get there fast enough. And so having more distributed forces can help with that. But it's also a recognition that in a lot of these places, partner nations are trying to fight extremism and terrorism, and they could use some help. And having our people there can probably make that process a lot better.
So are these new bases in these areas?
No, I don't think any of these would actually be entirely new. What would be new about them is it sounds like they would have larger complements of people sticking around for longer periods of time. And again, it didn't seem like any of the specific details of that were worked out. Having them be effective really will require that this military piece is integrated into whatever the broader strategy is for the area in which they're operating. What's the political and economic and diplomatic piece of it, and how does this new capability fit into that? So really actively managing these and having them be a part of a plan, that's the key to this kind of thing working or not working.
Vikram Singh is a former senior official at both the Pentagon and the State Department. He's now with the Center for American Progress in Washington. Thanks, Vikram.
Thank you.
This weekend, Saudi Arabia held an historic vote. For the first time in the country's history, women were allowed to vote and run for office in local elections. Fawzia Al-Bakr is a columnist and a professor at King Saud University in Riyadh, and she was one of those women who voted for the very first time.
It was wonderful. I tell you, it was just like a mental change because, you know, you feel yourself, you feel like a real citizen, that you have a say in something. And I think it's mental change because people now, you're not forced to accept things. You would choose. And I think that's going to change the Saudi Arabia for sure. I mean, all these women who went and vote for their candidate, they're going to come and change their children and, you know, educate them about voting and democracy. And so I think it's definitely a cultural change for Saudi Arabia.
I understand that voting in Saudi Arabia, like many things, is segregated by sex. So how did it actually work at the ballot box?
Oh, well, just fine because, you know, you go to a building. I mean, this is the men to the side and then the women to the other side in a different building, although it's the same building but just different room. And then you get to the women entrance and you just go, you know, behind a glass booth and, you know, you just choose and that's it. And, of course, I vote for a woman.
Did your candidate win?
No, unfortunately, no, she didn't. To be honest with you, I never thought there will be any seats for women. Because, I mean, when you look to the other Gulf states like Bahrain and United Arab Emirates and Kuwait, and they have a long history of women participation in different level of the government, you know, they hardly get any seats usually. We got 20 seats out of 1,006.
20 seats out of 1,006?
Yeah.
Now, how big of a deal is this for you personally? I mean, did you ever thought in your lifetime that you'd vote in the kingdom?
Because I think, you know, our society is changing so fast, faster than anybody, you know, expected. You know, there is an educated generation, the social media is there, so people, you know, can get information easily. So I think, you know, the aspiration of people are very high, and I think it's just a step forward in the right direction.
What's the next step you'd like to see happen?
Having a parliament, elected parliament that represents the people. Now we have what they call the Shura Council, which is an advisory council, you know, to the king, and 80% of their recommendation is taken by the government. However, still it's only an advisory board that appointed by the government itself. And we're lucky because there is also 30 women. So maybe next step it's going to be that we elect to be a parliament, not only an advisory board.
I guess my last question is, now that there are these, you know, 20 of these many, many municipal seats are held by women, what will they do? Will they be like meeting monthly or weekly? What's the forum under which they will conduct their new elected office?
I'm not really sure about the practical procedures they're going to follow. But I know, of course, they're going to meet, and I think they're going to change probably the way that these municipalities are conducted, because that's what happened in the advisory in the Shura Council. When the women got in, the whole dynamic of work within the Shura Council changed. So many, you know, women's issues came to the table. And now these women who work in the Shura, they are members of all the different committees. Actually, some of them are now the head of these committees, and they affect the decision-making process.
Fawzia Al-Bakr is a columnist and a professor at King Saud University in Riyadh. She voted for the first time ever this weekend. Coming up later in the show, Marco Werman joins me from Kenya. He's been getting to know the women who are running successful businesses there.
I've discovered there's a pretty high rate of women in business here in Kenya, all sorts of free enterprise, whether a woman is on the side of the road with a little stall selling onions or bananas, or women rising to the top of companies or creating business opportunities.
Women who are owning it in Kenya, that's ahead here on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Our next story could change the way you look at that shrimp cocktail this holiday season. Turns out a lot of the peeled shrimp we eat here in America comes from Thailand, and much of it is the product of slave labor, according to a report by the Associated Press. It's part of an ongoing investigation into the seafood industry by the AP. Martha Mendoza is part of the investigative team. Martha, when you say slave labor, what do you mean specifically?
Well, earlier this year, we reported men put into cages when their boats came to shore. This most recent report today looks at people who are locked inside of shrimp peeling sheds in Thailand and forced to peel shrimp that enter the supply chains of popular U.S. stores.
Are they unpaid
The way this typically works is they are paid little to no wages and they owe a tremendous amount of money because they have been tricked or lured by a broker into heading out of their country for a job that they're promised will allow them to send money home to their family. Instead, when they get there, they find out that they owe somebody as much money as they've been sold for, and they have to work to pay that off, as well as pay for their lodging and food, and they're not allowed to leave until they pay that off, and the debt can be insurmountable.
So it's literally a captive labor force.
Very much so, but it's uniquely persistent with seafood, in part because a lot of the slavery can take place at sea where there's little oversight, and in part because it's quite a complex supply chain. In our case with the shrimp, we found that major Thai seafood producers, when they would come up short of their shrimp, would outsource some of the work to these smaller peeling sheds that might not have oversight.
What are these peeling sheds like that you talk about?
They are filthy. There are toilets overflowing. They are unhygienic. There's children. One girl was so tiny she had to stand on a stool to reach the peeling table. People had been in there for months, and always somebody's watching them.
This is not an entirely new story. Haven't there been repeated promises by businesses and government to clean up the industry?
Yes, for years now, media and NGO reports have been saying that Thai's seafood sector is using a lot of forced and modern-day slavery. What we've sought to do this year was identify exactly where those products end up, what supply chains they go to. And to do that, we actually had to stake out and follow products. From the processing sheds, we would drive behind a truck with our own video and photo and take pictures of where it goes.
And where did the shrimp end up?
Most major U.S. food stores and retailers, such as Walmart, Kroger, Whole Foods, Dollar General, pet stores like Petco, restaurants like Red Lobster and Olive Garden. It also entered supply chains of some of America's best-known seafood brands and pet foods, including Chicken of the Sea and Fancy Feast, grocery stores like Safeway and Schnucks, Piggly Wiggly, Albertsons. AP reporters in 50 states found shrimp products from supply chains tainted with this forced labor.
What have the companies said in response?
Everyone who responded says they deplore labor abuses. And some say they've been assured by Thailand that the shrimp that ended up in their stores and restaurants didn't come from these abusive supply chains.
Would customer boycotts be effective here in pressuring stores not to buy the shrimp?
There are members of Congress, even an ambassador for anti-trafficking at the State Department, who say consumers should not buy seafood if they know that it's associated with these supply chains of forced labor and slavery. The companies and the seafood industry say that's counterproductive and that it can take the U.S. dollars out of the industry and therefore take the U.S. pressure out of the industry.
And of course, as a consumer, how do you know that the shrimp you're looking at in a supermarket was shrimp prepared by slaves?
You can't know. There's no way to track a particular shrimp from an abusive peeling shed to a supermarket store. However, if you want to assure yourself that you are having shrimp that has a clean supply chain, you can buy local.
Has what you found out changed your own behavior regarding eating shrimp?
I've never eaten fish or shrimp in my life, actually. I've been brought up as a vegetarian, and so it's all the same to me.
Associated Press reporter Martha Mendoza, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Here in Boston, we're very proud of our sports teams. But when it comes to basketball, I have to admit it's been a while since the Celtics have wowed anyone. They could really use a new superstar, like a college kid who turns the franchise around all by himself. Yeah, it's a dream. But the world's Bradley Campbell thinks he's got just the guy for the job.
I saw the future of basketball by accident. He appeared on my smartphone. I was watching college hoops on the ESPN app, and that's when he appeared, sprinting down the court. Ben Simmons.
As Fisher missed, Simmons! Oh, coast to coast!
Yeah, coast to coast. He made it look easy. So easy it looked fake. Hence the ESPN announcers laughing in disbelief. Here are basic facts you should know about Ben Simmons. He's a 6'10" freshman. He plays for Louisiana State University. He's already being compared to both Magic and LeBron. Scouts flock to his games. He's widely expected to be the number one pick in the next NBA draft. That's why many consider him the future of basketball, especially people who live in the future, Australians. They're 16 hours ahead.
Ben Simmons is the one that has the package. He has everything. And if he can develop that jump shot, we're talking about, you know, a future NBA All-Star here in the making, if not more than that.
Damian Arsenis blogs about Australian basketball for the website The Pick and Roll. He gets to watch Ben Simmons play live because ESPN Australia is broadcasting almost every LSU basketball game. They come on in the middle of the day, but people still watch. As you've probably guessed by now, Simmons is Australian, the prince of the sport down under. His father played professionally there, and local hoops fan in Melbourne have known about this kid for years. He was a child prodigy.
You just saw that talent was just oozing from him, and it was that level above. It was like you had this older kid playing against younger kids.
It still looks that way. On the court, against college athletes, it looks like Simmons is playing against high school kids. It's not fair. The impressive part is how he plays. It's the Australian way. Selfless.
The Australians are team-first players. They're brought up being part of a team, that they're focused on being a team and not being about me.
Not to say he doesn't score. He dropped 43 points on North Florida this season. Only two other LSU players have done that before. You may have heard of them. Shaq and Pistol Pete. Such feats are why people are rocking LSU Tiger gear on the streets of Melbourne. They're proud of Ben Simmons, and they're proud of Australian basketball. When you look at the current NBA, you can spot Australians holding down roster spots on some of the top teams. And Aussie basketball fans are pumped.
Oh, it's very exciting. Look, basketball's on the rise. We've got so much talent coming through, and it really just needs a face to help drive that. And I think Ben Simmons can be that face.
Arsenis is already dreaming about who Simmons will play for when he turns pro. In the NBA, the worst teams in the league get the first picks at the end of the season. And this year, one of the most famous teams in the league, the Los Angeles Lakers, are also one of the worst.
Seriously? Imagine if Ben Simmons landed on the Lakers. Imagine what that would do for basketball worldwide for Australia.
Now, that's getting a little ahead of ourselves. Ben Simmons still has to finish his college season. And draft day, that's a long ways away. But that's what happens when you watch him play. He's so good, you just can't help but think about the future. For The World, I'm Bradley Campbell.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Years ago, a young Kenyan girl named Halima lost her parents, but her grandfather was there for her.
Something just hit my heart, and I decided I better sacrifice myself to take care of her.
Now Halima successfully runs her own business in a Kenyan slum. She's owning it, just ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. If you're a regular listener to the show, you know it's usually Marco Werman who sits in the host chair. Right now, though, Marco's on assignment in Kenya, together with our Across Women's Lives team. And all this week, they're bringing us stories about business, women, and economic empowerment. Let's go to Kenya now. And Marco, how's Nairobi?
Nairobi is great. It looks like there are rain clouds up in the sky, but the light is just extraordinary right now. I'm talking to you from the giant slum of Kibera, which is the largest slum in sub-Saharan Africa. The team and I, we've been to a lot of places over the past several days to find out really what women are doing to empower themselves through business. Biashara, the Swahili word for business, as I've now learned. I've discovered there's a pretty high rate of women in business here in Kenya, all sorts of free enterprise, whether a woman is on the side of the road with a little stall selling onions or bananas, or women rising to the top of companies or creating business opportunities, like the young woman I met from the slums who teaches yoga 7 days a week. But we're going to start today here in Nairobi in the slum of Kibera. Night is falling, open fire starting up for dinner. A lot of people striving to make it, and the odds are not good that they will make it. Daily life is kind of hand-to-mouth. But as I saw, there are some young women who are trying to break that pattern. They're actually saving money and saving themselves. And maybe, just maybe, they could help save Kibera. This is a story of one girl. It's also the story of other girls she met who, like her, wanted more than Kibera would give them.
My parents used to go to the bars, night discos, and all that, leaving me alone in the house.
That is Halima Sadiq Muhammad. She's 16. When she was a toddler, her dad was often out somewhere, rarely held down a job, a lot of drugs. Her mother ran a speakeasy inside their shack.
She was selling alcohol. The men usually came to the house. They usually drank the alcohol. They smoked bhang, cigarettes and all that.
By the time Halima was 10, both her parents had died from drinking and drugs. Before they died, though, Halima had someone looking out for her, her grandfather on her dad's side, Muhammad Ramadan Fadal.
I could hear her crying. When I go there, nobody's in the house. It went for so long, then I decided this child cannot be brought by them. I better sacrifice myself to take care of her. Something just hit my heart. She is my granddaughter.
And now Grandfather Muhammad is Halima's proud parent. He even hangs on to Halima's childhood clothes.
When she was this size.
That fits like a 4-year-old.
4 years old, yeah.
Halima's a little embarrassed by the hole-ridden pants she wore when she was a little girl, but she rolls with it because her grandfather is proud of her. And this is why. She's excelled in the school he enrolled her in. It's for children in need, and she always came out first, second, or third in the class. She got her primary school certificate, and now she and some of the girls she's met in school are changing the neighborhood. To show me what she meant, Halima took me to a place called the Mashujaa. That means heroes in Swahili, and when you see what they're doing, it is nothing short of heroic. The concept is simple. It's young people saving money together. No one person controls the lockbox. They have a bank account, and there must be consensus on withdrawals. Halima's taking me to the weekly Sunday afternoon meeting of the Mashujaa. We walk down the muddy alleys between corrugated metal hovels and get to an open area where other group members have already arrived. So the meetings happen here. How many people usually show up for the Mashujaa meetings?
Actually, we have a lot of members, but some of them, they mainly go to job, but they send their money.
The girls and boys here raise money on their own. The girls sell beaded jewelry for a few shillings. Some of the boys sell candy. They've got a garden out back and rabbit hutches, and they sell what they raise. Together, they spend some time picking up trash in Kibera, and there's a lot of it that the city of Nairobi is not cleaning up, and neighbors pay them to do that. They have toilet facilities that people pay them to use. Even in the Mashujaa clubhouse, they have a PlayStation with video games that they charge kids a few shillings to play for 10 minutes a go. And then at the weekly meeting, the fruits of their labor are tallied.
I don't have the balance. Wait.
The treasurer of the Mashujaa, a 20-year-old named Miriam, she's Halima's aunt, in fact, calls out the names of those in attendance. They stand up and bring Miriam money. Most of it comes in the form of small change. Then Miriam announces today's total.
300.
300 shillings. That's just $3. But that's only one meeting. Over 2.5 years since the project kicked off, the Mashujaa has raised over 49,000 shillings, nearly $500, and they're earning interest. If one of the members of the Mashujaa wants to withdraw money, the group has to agree. One young man at the meeting needed a few hundred shillings, and the consensus was he should get it with the understanding that he'd pay it back in 24 hours. The project started with the assistance of CARE International. Mercy Njaji is with the organization's Kenya office.
They are able to come up with small businesses that they can earn living through savings and loan. They are able to put dinner on the table. Through savings and loan, they are able to go to school.
Look at this area, Kibera, 10 years from now. Yeah. What can you imagine happening if these Mashujaas continue?
I would say Kibera would become very, very different because through these girls who right now they are having a better and a decent way of earning money rather than finding themselves into prostitutions, on early marriages, on early pregnancies. I think in the next near future, Kibera would be very different with empowered girls. But I know if we had so many Mashujaas around, Kibera would be very, very different.
Marco, it's a pretty inspiring story, but I do have a question. Kibera is a huge place with lots of problems. Can kids in one of the biggest ghettos in the world who are really bringing in just a few dollars a day make that big a difference?
You know, when you step back and you look at Kibera, the tin roofs seem to go on forever in every direction. The garbage seems like it'll never, ever get cleaned up entirely. It can only go on like this forever. That's the way it feels. And then you wonder if there is will at the top for this to change. You know, there's this big corruption scandal in Kenya right now. The government sold like $2.7 billion in Eurobonds, and the money has mysteriously disappeared. It's become very politicized. Everybody is angry. And I asked Halima about that. I said, look, at the highest levels of government, there constantly seem to be these schemes afoot to whisk money away, lots and lots of money, no accountability. And here you are in Kibera with your little savings club, and there is strict accountability. No one person can run off with the savings. And I asked Halima, can a group of girls from Kibera actually change the culture around money in Kenya? And you know what? She quoted Barack Obama. She reminded me of his 2008 campaign slogan, "Yes, we can." And Halima said, if after what she went through as a girl, and now I'm making a difference in my community, then it is totally possible. Yes, she can. She repeated again, yes, she can. So that's where the hope lies, in the determination of these young women.
Thanks, Marco. So what do you have coming up tomorrow?
Well, I'm glad you asked. Let me bring in Gina Moore from BuzzFeed. Gina is their international women's rights correspondent. She's based here in Nairobi. But Gina, you're almost always on the road, so we're actually really lucky to have you reporting a few stories for us this week. You'll be with us tomorrow on The World. Tell me what you've been working on.
Tomorrow we're going to talk about fashion in Kenya, which thrills me because there's so much exciting stuff happening here. I also think it's a place where women aren't really taken seriously as businesswomen or haven't been, but that's starting to change. And it's a really interesting thing to follow how that's changing and what it means for the women who've taken risks to be entrepreneurs in that way.
So in your story about fashion, are women working together?
You know, there's this kind of assumption in this world of people excited about promoting female entrepreneurship that women want to support other women. And everyone I talked to said that's not how it works at the beginning.
A lot of women, and not just African women, I think we're our own worst enemies. If you have stuff you're doing, your own friends or family would be the last guys to buy.
That is kind of fascinating stuff, a word I use, because it's kind of about these little hats called fascinators, right?
The woman we've just heard has launched a business selling fascinators, which are those tiny little hats that Kate Middleton loves. And she is accessorizing the elite here in Kenya.
Gina Moore from BuzzFeed, who will be with us on The World this week as we broadcast from Nairobi. Gina, thanks so much. Glad you're with us. Also, Carol, I want listeners to know about a special feature we've got at PRI.org. I want you to imagine what it is like to be a woman in Kenya in 2015. Actually, you don't have to imagine, because we've got this interactive quiz, a questionnaire of sorts that will compare and contrast your life to that of a Kenyan woman today. And you can take the quiz and see for yourselves. It's really cool, and you may discover some really great music at the same time. So, Carol, I'm going to sign off now from Kibera here in Nairobi, Kenya. Back to you guys in Boston.
And you can follow all of our Owning It stories using the hashtag Owning It. Plus, check out behind-the-scenes moments from Marco Werman and the team in Kenya via Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/acrosswomenslives. In the Netflix show Master of None, comedian Aziz Ansari covers a lot of ground. Yeah, there's the romantic drama you might expect on most sitcoms, but there's also stuff that TV usually doesn't spend much time on. One early episode is all about the relationship between immigrant children and their parents. That's a topic Ping Huang knows something about, so she decided to watch the show with her own immigrant parents in Waltham, Massachusetts.
The first time I watched the parents' episode of Master of None, it hit me like a revelation. I laughed. I got a little teary-eyed. It was so spot on in describing my experience as the child of immigrants. In the show, the friends Dev and Brian are bonding over the weirdness of their parents. Dev's are from India, Brian's are from Taiwan, and at some point, Brian is thinking about doing something nice for his dad, and he is stumped.
I mean, what would I get my dad for a gift? He doesn't really have any interests. I mean, he likes drinking water, staying hydrated. I could get him a gallon of water as a gift.
The gifts my sister and I have gotten our parents have been super practical, and based on that exact line of reasoning, I don't know, what could Mom use? One time, we got her a wall-mounted trash can that reuses bags from the grocery store. Another year, we got them a water-saving device for their toilet. The show had a point. What do I really know about my parents? And if I'm honest, it's kind of like what Brian tells Dev about his dad.
I mean, I know the big points. He was poor. He was in another country. It was tough. Then he came here. I mean, you know, I got the gist of it.
Wasn't that the gist of every immigrant story? That it was hard?
So Dev and Brian take their parents out for a fact-finding dinner. They asked them what it was like growing up in a different country and what they did on their first days in America. These are questions I've always wondered about my parents but have never asked. And here is my chance. So I watched the parents' episode with my own parents, Xu Chen and Zhen Song Huang. The first thing they both said was that it was spot on for them too.
It's very touched my heart. I'm really the Chinese guy's father. It's the same exactly.
My dad sees himself in Brian's dad, a stoic Taiwanese immigrant who can't think of a single noteworthy story from his childhood to tell his son. My mom identifies with Dev's Indian mom, who was too scared to answer the phone when she first got to the U.S. because people wouldn't understand her accent.
Even now, I still don't like to answer the phone at all because I think my language is not perfect. So if I answer the phone, I may mess up things.
I was just two when we came to the U.S., so I don't remember the move. What I do remember is having the most Chinese-American upbringing ever. I played the piano and the violin, I went to math enrichment on Saturdays, and I could never go to birthday parties because I had Chinese school on Sundays. All that structure and the emphasis on grades, I thought my parents hated fun. As Dev's dad says in the show,
"You realize fun is a new thing, right? Fun is a luxury only your generation really has."
What I didn't realize until I talked with my parents was the uncertainty of it all. My whole childhood, they projected such confidence. You just sit there and study. We'll take care of the rest. And they did. They worried about all the big stuff. What will we eat? How will we live? Did we make the right choice? And they hid it all from us. They never had a grand plan. Just hope and faith that striving would get us to a better place.
We came here, the whole purpose is we want our kids to have a better life. That's why I push you kind of hard, right? Though you don't like, but at that time you hate it. But now think of bigger, you should appreciate it. I don't know if you're not, but I think you should.
And I am grateful. As far as sacrifices go, missing all the birthday parties pales in comparison to what my parents gave up. They left creative careers, property, and family in Taiwan to start over here. They work so hard. My dad is a restaurant owner, my mom is a dental assistant, and they never socialize or go on vacations. I'm in my 30s now, around the same age as my parents when they came to the U.S., and the idea of starting over completely seems like such a hard call to make.
It is hard. It is hard. So do I regret? Not really.
The show's call to action, Under the Satire, is for parents and kids to reach out a little bit more. And it's not like it's opened the floodgates. We are definitely not having weekly talks about our feelings. But that little bit of connection has been just right for my family. And immigrant parents, man, they just keep on giving. After answering all of my probing questions, my parents sent me home with enough food for the whole week and a Christmas cactus. And though, to this day, my parents have literally never said, "I love you," they do say stuff like this.
"That's a success to come to this country because our kids, they turn out pretty good. So you give me my American dream come true." Okay.
Okay. For the world, Ping Huang, Waltham.
Catch what WGBH reporters Rupa Shenoy and Arun Rath have to say about the Masters of None Parents episode on the new Otherhood podcast at PRI.org. Just ahead, a closer look at that big climate deal over the weekend, plus the parkour scene in Afghanistan. Seriously, you're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills with The World. Let me take you back to the big moment this weekend when cheers erupted after a new agreement got unanimous approval at the Paris Climate Summit. Okay, now the reality check. What's the new deal actually mean? For that, we turn to The World's environment editor, Peter Thompson. He was in Paris for the summit, and he's still roaming the streets there today.
The gist really is that 196 countries from around the world got together and said, definitively, climate change is a huge problem. We have to deal with it. They didn't get very specific on how they were going to do it, but they did say we want to shoot to a target of well below 2 degrees centigrade rise in temperatures with an eye toward 1.5. That's a big change from where we were coming in.
What does it compel countries to do?
It compels them to draw up plans to cut their emissions every 5 years and to revisit those plans every 5 years as the science comes in and we know more about what climate change is actually doing to the planet, as technology improves and we have more ability to fight it. It does not actually compel anybody to enact those changes. Strangely, it doesn't technically require them to actually do it.
Now, I know at the last moment it seemed that things might get held up because the U.S. objected to a single word in the accord, the word shall. What was going on with that?
Well, you know, that gets to the heart of one of the biggest conflicts around this entire arrangement. The United States has not been willing to commit to a specific level of cuts because that would require a document to be brought before the U.S. Senate as a new treaty. That would be a non-starter. They're not going to do that. So they needed and demanded an agreement that would require some things, but it would not require that. And it's interesting, you know, this agreement was delayed and delayed. The original deadline was Friday evening at 6. It didn't happen. They pushed it to the morning. In the morning, they pushed it to noon. At noon, they pushed it to 3. At 3, they pushed it to 7. And then finally, foreign minister and the president of the meeting, Laurent Fabius, came before the microphones and apologized for the delay and said there were technical errors and there were translation errors, and they got on with it. Turns out that what was going on in that time was that that word shall had somehow emerged in the final draft, and John Kerry saw it, and he said, we cannot do this. And they haggled over it. Kerry ultimately apparently said, we know this was just a mistake. It has been fixed. It has been turned back into should. And they went ahead and they gaveled it through.
What's odd, Peter, is that the 31-page accord does not mention fossil fuels, but isn't that the core of the problem of global warming?
That is a reflection of the difficulty of the process. They mentioned the problem. They didn't mention the chief cause of the problem. There were certain countries that would not stand for that. However, it does set up mechanisms to bring down emissions. It doesn't say what causes those emissions, but it says you need to bring down emissions. So there's a lot of diplo speak, but it does have this basic substance of requiring countries to report what they're going to do, putting a tremendous amount of pressure on them to do what they say they're going to do, and then providing mechanisms for mostly rich countries to help mostly poor countries, help pay for technology transition to clean energy, to help pay for adapting to climate change when the effects can't be avoided, and to avoid the effects when they can be.
You covered the climate talks in Copenhagen 6 years ago. What changed? I mean, what made the difference this time between no deal and a deal?
I think the extent of the problem has become so clear in the last 6 years. Nobody is arguing that point anymore. Everybody knows this is here, this is now, this is real, and it's only going to get worse, especially China. China really was in the tent this time instead of outside the tent, and they could have stopped this. They didn't. We could have stopped this. We didn't. There has also been a tremendous advance in technology in the last 6 years. The amount of new green energy that is coming online in the world is just phenomenal, and the prices are falling incredibly fast. And there is also a global movement, which there just wasn't 6 years ago. There was a hint of a global movement starting to arise really around Copenhagen, but it's taken off since then and is putting pressure on politicians all around the world. So all of those things together created this moment. Everybody said it was going to happen. Nobody was absolutely certain it was going to happen until Laurent Fabius brought down that gavel on Saturday night.
Of course, proof will be in the pudding. The World's Environment editor Peter Thompson in Paris.
Thanks, Carol.
You can read more of Peter's analysis of the climate deal and what's ahead at PRI.org. Finally today, a different side of Afghanistan. In recent years, most stories out of that country have had to do with war or the Taliban. Leave that aside for a few minutes and consider the rise of parkour in Kabul, Afghanistan. The French-inspired urban climbing phenomenon has apparently gained a following there. My BBC colleague Khalil Nouri has been following the scene. He's in Kabul himself. Khalil, to someone who's never seen parkour, what do you see when you watch people do it?
It is jumping, rushing over walls. It is running. The parkour team, which is playing and exercising in Kabul, they're jumping from one wall to another wall, from one roof to another roof, and exercises like gymnastics.
So do they do flips and handstands and things?
Yes, flips, and they stand on hands, and then they're just practicing the first stages.
Do women do it as well as men?
No, it is only a team of boys and includes right now 10 people.
So I'm guessing they're kind of teenagers, early 20s kind of age?
It is all university students between 18 up to 20, 24, 22, something like this. They are all teenagers and young boys.
What kind of reaction do they get from the people around them?
Of course, because it is a new phenomenon in the country, they themselves, parkour players, afraid that people may make joke of them. That's why they're not practicing in the public sites inside the city.
Now, I know the group of guys you followed, they call themselves Afghan Parkour Generation, and I understand they've encountered some problems lately. What's going on?
Well, when the Afghan Parkour team was established about 3 years ago, there were 25 members, and unfortunately, more than half of the team members left as immigrants to Europe. At the moment, only 10 members of the parkour team is left in Kabul, and they are continuing their exercises.
Things have been difficult in Afghanistan for years. I'm wondering why these parkour players are choosing to leave now and moving on to Europe.
Many reasons behind their leaving the country, the insecurity in the country, the economic crisis, joblessness and lack of job opportunities in the country has been the biggest problem since the years and decades in the country. And we believe that the parkour member has left to find and look after better job opportunities and life chances, because in the 10 months we have more than 150,000 migrants, Afghan migrants, who have reached Europe countries. Dozens of, even hundreds of Afghans are trying to leave the country. They are leaving the country.
The BBC's Khalil Nouri in Kabul. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
And that's all today from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.